I'll do a short intro, and then I'll bring you on in.
Is there a music cue?
We'll put the music in later, Miles.
What kind of music?
Do you have any recommendations?
Horror music.
Oh, horror music. Well, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. It may end up being horror music. All right, here we go. From PRX, it's How to Be Amazing, your guidebook for becoming amazing. Each week on How to Be Amazing, I speak with people from all walks of life who do amazing things. Today on the program, he's gone from being a prop stylist on a home shopping network to becoming the head writer. What, you're laughing? That's what you did.
I know. It's good research. I had no idea that that would show up. That's great.
Today on the program, can I introduce you?
Sure.
He's gone from being a prop stylist on a home shopping network to becoming head writer of The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, a position he's held since its inception as Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. As head writer, his job is to create the funny. That's everything from overseeing sketches to deciding which jokes make it to Jimmy. Today, I talked to A.D. Miles about how he approaches his work on one of the most iconic and demanding television franchises.
I will tell you, there were plenty of times in that first year where I genuinely thought I was going to have a heart attack. But every day, I have two or three moments where I have a genuine belly laugh, and the joy of that is something I could imagine myself doing forever.
Full disclosure, I have known you since you worked in the art department of a sketch comedy show that I was on called The State.
That's correct.
We've since worked on many projects together.
Mm-hmm.
You were a frequent guest on my nightclub show, Stella. We've been in a couple movies together.
Couple, that's right.
So I know you, but mm-hmm. I don't know you as a writer. I've never worked with you in that capacity. So this is all new to me.
Right.
And I'm excited.
It's weird.
A.D. Miles, welcome to How to Be Amazing.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, you've just literally come from a taping of The Tonight Show.
We finished taping about an hour ago, and I did a little bit of editing. We cut some snippets out. The fat, as you say.
So instead of talking about, I think, probably a question you get a lot, what's a typical day like at mm-hmm. The Tonight Show, tell me about today. What happened today that was normal, that was abnormal?
Today, in the sense of what was normal, this is the best part of my job. What was normal about today was that I was extremely tired. I didn't sleep well the night before, I was a little exhausted, and I came into work and I had so many good laughs that I felt better at the end of the day than I did at the beginning of it.
Well, you've also got a 2.5-year-old at home, so that's exhausting.
Yeah, that's part of it. That's part of it. So I get sapped, and then I come in, and we had a particularly good taping tonight, and after the first act, which is where most of the comedy happens, I do something I don't often do, which is I crossed over to Jimmy in between the commercial break, and just was like, that was just a really great, a lot of laughs there. And I genuinely needed the laughs almost as an audience member as much as I did as someone who worked on the show. It was just a lot of fun.
So when you do that, when you cross over to him and you go, that was really funny, does he ever go, are you saying that all the other shows we do where you don't come over aren't funny? Because that's what I would be thinking.
He usually says, what are you doing here? I need to get powdered. And exactly. Well, I actually, when we first started doing the show, sometimes, you know, like I get hyper-focused on the thing that I'm supposed to be involved in. And at the end, we always have sort of a little debriefing after every show where we kind of talk about what went right and what went wrong. And I would always start it by going like, man, that first act was amazing. And then it would just by default, just sort of everybody else in the room was like, well, what the fuck was the rest of it supposed to be? The rest of it wasn't so great. But that first act, man, whoo, that was delicious.
Oh, it really sang.
Really sang. But then whatever happened after that, I don't know.
You just check out.
Yeah.
Because the show is new every day, meaning you have to construct a show from soup to nuts mm-hmm. every single day, are you ever comfortable? I mean, is there ever a moment where you walk in and you're in and there's not panic? I know if it was me,
no,
I'd
there
walk
isn't.
In panicked
there,
every day.
There really isn't. And I'm hoping, I've read some things that high-stress situations actually are like, in a weird way, like exercise, and they help you live longer. I hope that's the case, because if it isn't, I'm going to die tomorrow.
Well, you look great.
Thank you.
We were talking about this before you walked in, but Miles, it really got dressed up for the occasion. He's wearing a very fashionable button-up cardigan.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a terrific gray patterned tie, a white button-down shirt. I don't know if this is how you dress for the show.
It's my uniform. Uh-huh. I wear the same thing every day. I'm the only one that dresses like this in the office. It's not a job requirement, but it's something that I've always done.
And why do you do it?
I don't know. I think it makes me feel like I'm going. It gets me in the vibe of like this is important. We're doing something.
Right.
It's totally not necessary. There's incredibly talented people on the show that don't dress like this at all and come up with very, very funny stuff. So it's I don't know why I do it. Just it's a quirk, I guess.
Well, it's a quirk that suits you because, as I said, you look great.
Thank you.
I mean, okay. I haven't seen you with your shirt off. I don't want to see you with your shirt off.
It all falls apart. When the Spanx come off, everything falls apart.
So is the Tonight Show, separating it from the Late Show, is the Tonight Show different from on show 30? Are you starting to see an evolution, or do you feel like you guys hit the ground running and you kind of knew what the show was already?
I don't know. I would never be so presumptuous to think we knew what it was going to be. But I do think that what we're finding is that the show that we've been that we were making at late night has transferred pretty well to the Tonight Show, and a lot of the bits we did on late night we brought with us, and they've weathered the transition well. And we're starting to kind of settle in and feel comfortable in the new studio. It felt very much like we went from driving a beat-up Volvo to driving the family Mercedes or something. But it's a nicer car. But oh my God, I'm going to push the metaphor. But it still gets you from point A to point.
How's the mileage?
Less mileage. The other car was more efficient. We got about 38 miles per gallon on the highway. This show, we get about 27, which is still good.
I tell you.
Yeah, it's a diesel, though, so it's not apples to oranges.
Well, that Mercedes has been chugging along now for, 60 years?
60
Tonight
years,
show.
Yeah. It's a beautiful machine.
And I wonder, you guys are taking over for Leno, and he had his audience, The Late Show had its audience. Do you find that there's a lot of overlap? Do you feel like you're able to bring the Leno Tonight Show over to your show?
Yeah. I mean, that was the crucial test. We knew that Leno had been on top for 22 years, so he obviously had the largest section of the audience. And we were, a coefficient of his rating every night, basically just doing what we did and hoping that people were still watching. And the ratings have gone up, actually, which is bizarre, but which means that everybody that was watching Leno has taken a peek and stuck around, that's a relief and it's good news. And, yeah.
Or that just the people who are watching now happen to have Nielsen boxes.
That.
And, you don't know.
It also could be that people fall asleep during the weather.
Right. It could be that the weather has gotten a lot more boring.
Well, the polar vortex, it draws a lot of people to the news. And so a lot of people just fall asleep and whatever, man.
So I want to ask you about literally the job of head writer.
Okay.
I don't know what a head writer does as opposed to a writer. You said that it sounded like you're focused primarily on the first act of the show, which is when the bulk of the comedy comes in.
We do a lot of guest pieces that require writing as well, like a lot of games and bits. But primarily it's the first act of the show.
What distinguishes you from just the writers?
I do a lot less writing.
Uh-huh. Because I always thought the head writer, that must just be the funniest guy in the room. And then there's a secret ballot, and they name somebody the head writer.
I think that it's a weird job. It should be called writer manager, maybe. There are writers on the show that write way more every day than I do. Every writer writes more than I do every day. They churn out tons of material. And I guess if anything, my job is just to sort of it's quality control, basically, to make sure that we're focused on the right things and that we kind of push from the bottom, in the sense that everybody gets tired eventually and. We have to make sure that we're always coming up with the best possible stuff we can every day, to make sure that Jimmy gets the best material to choose from.
And, I know you originally as somebody who created his own content. You were a writer and director of short films. You created a couple of television shows, including one called Horrible People, which was a soap opera about it was a soap opera, but it was a parody of soap operas. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
That's something that people do when they're in between phases of their career. I think that we had done Wet Hot, and unlike Bradley Cooper and and almost everyone else in that movie, I didn't become a big movie star.
Well, you're talking to the other guy who didn't become a big movie star from that movie.
Which was a shocker to me. I was really... Because you know what's so funny about that? It was like, the year that we went to Sundance with Wet Hot American Summer. It was also the year that I was in a movie called The Believer with another unknown actor who since hasn't done anything named Ryan Gosling. Mm-hmm. And so I had a drama and a screwball comedy at Sundance at the same time. That other movie, The Believer, won the grand jury prize. And I was thinking, like, well, this is basically at the point where you stop auditioning, right?
Of course.
Yeah. No. Oh, run-of-the-mill, redheaded nerd. There's plenty of you out there. So,
yeah, you were on the launch pad. The smoke was coming out. The countdown had started. At about three, they said, abort, abort, abort.
Abort, abort, abort. Exactly. So, you know, you scramble and you just try to figure out ways to stay creative and Horrible People was that, basically. I was hanging out with Joe Latruglio, who I've dabbled with. We kind of kept each other going, you know, writing little things together here and there. And that was based on a play that I wrote called The Beach House. It was a one-act play where it was a 30-minute play where everybody shows up at a beach house excited about a weekend in the Hamptons, and within 30 minutes in real time, everyone has killed each other and they're all dead. And so Horrible People was sort of an extension of that. And got super lucky and the people we worked with on that and made a pretty faithful recreation of soap operas, which I'm still very proud of to this day. It was fun.
Well, we have a clip of Horrible People, so why don't we take a listen to that?
Why are you wearing that sweater tied around your neck?
I don't know, in case it gets cold.
So why don't you just wear the sweater?
Because I like the way that it looks.
And then he's killing her with the sweater,
right? Yeah, he's choking her with the sweater. He's so mad that she's wearing a sweater around her neck. And by the way, this was in the first 30 seconds of the piece, which also in the one-act film, the one-act play, rather, someone gets killed within the first 2 minutes of the play, which there was something I read a long time ago about writing, which is if you ever want to have a horse race in a play, you better get the horses warmed up backstage so that you're ready to go. And I liked that idea where whatever you're doing, you know, something should happen right away to bring people in.
So the humor of something like Horrible People or a show called Hot Sluts, which you created, which was kind of a parody of, I don't know, sort of 80s-ish late night syndicated garbage shows.
Yes, exactly.
All of that is it's very specific humor. And in my mind, it's not the kind of thing that I would think would translate to 11:30 or 10:30 Central Time, mid-America. Mm-hmm. And so when I talk about your voice and your tone and how you went from creating something for yourself to creating material for somebody else, can you talk about that transition?
Well, it's interesting because both of those things were exercises in extremely detailed, faithful recreations of genre. And that served me pretty well at this job because we do very elaborate parodies on at late night and soon on the Tonight Show. You know, Late was our Lost parody. We've done Downton Sixby, which was a parody of Downton Abbey. The Real Housewives of Late Night was a parody of those Bravo shows. And the detail that everybody brings to the projects are always, you know, there's just. We don't spare any expense. It's wardrobe. Everything looks exactly the way it's supposed to look on the real show. And I think that's something I brought with me from those projects. And there's just something very interesting to me about of recreating a world. I think there's a sort of subtle subtext joke that happens when you create something so specifically and so faithfully that I don't know. The humor rings a little bit more when. The more seriously you take an absurd premise, I think sometimes the funnier it is.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that I've noticed too. I mean, there's that humor of recognition, of recognizing that thing, and when
that's exactly what it is.
When you put when you do that kind of faithful recreation and you just take the thing and put it in the context of comedy, I wonder if that somehow releases it into being funny.
Absolutely. There's a I don't know where this term came from, but that the term drama for comedy, where the more serious you are in service of a joke, the funnier the joke becomes. And no one's mugging, no one's doing like the really overt setup punchline. It's more about the fact that you're being so serious about someone who is so incensed that someone would wear a sweater around their neck that he would say, you know what? I honestly, I've known this person for 30 seconds. I can't take it. I will choke them to death. And I will leave their carcass next to the front door of a dinner party, and that's where they'll stay.
As you do the Tonight Show now, oh, you're just cracking yourself up.
I am. I still love it. I still love the fact that in Horrible People—
Well, you're clearly a lover of sweaters.
Yeah, the woman wearing a cardigan right now, which I will kill someone with if I have to. But I still love the fact that in that that Horrible People, that the dead body that was killed within the first 30 seconds stayed there for the entire 10-episode run.
Oh, that actress must have loved that.
She loved it, yeah. Big breaking part for her.
Right, that was her on the launch pad going, after this, my career's made.
I was the one that got choked within 30 seconds of an internet parody series. Hello?
How much of your sensibility do you feel like you have to alter or change for the Tonight Show, or do you? Do you feel like you're being your truest self for that show, and in service of your boss, Jimmy Fallon?
It's about the things that you don't even see on the screen. It's about the moments where we're building the show during the day, where we basically have a sort of Groundhog's Day kind of like repetitive. We do the same meetings every day at the exact same time. And the only relief from that is doing bits, and which is the biggest pleasure of being a comedian and working in comedy. The way that we worked on The State, Wet Hot American Summer, which you know, back the behind the scenes of Wet Hot American Summer was just nonstop bits that had really nothing to do with the movie, but they still informed the vibe of the production and the relationships between all the players. And that's exactly what we do on The Tonight Show and Late Night all day long. And those little things show up in between jokes. They're the forms of voices and little accents, and it's little jokes that we just come up with that fill in the cracks. And
You were saying that you consider your job almost being a manager of writers.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean that you're the guy who has to fire writers?
I do sometimes. It's unfortunate and it's unpleasant.
I can't imagine. How does that go? Is it like the manager of a baseball team where you come in and it's like, well, you know, you're a great baseball player, but you're just not right
exactly
for our team?
It's exactly like that. It's not something I ever take lightly, and I don't take pleasure in it in any sense. And it goes well sometimes and it goes poorly others. And I always try to imagine being on the other side of it. And I've been on the other side of it. I've been fired from jobs before. And it's not fun. And it's I just assume the way that I turned it around or dealt with it, that they will. And I hope they all go on to better things.
When were you fired?
I worked on Bruno, the movie Bruno, for a little while.
You got fired from Bruno?
I would say that I was not invited back. I wrote on Bruno for a little while, and none of my jokes were getting into the movie. And I remember the producer of the film, who I'd known from a couple of other projects, basically just took me aside one day, like at lunch or something, and just said, "Hey, there'll be a car coming around in about an hour to pick you up and take you to the airport." I was like, "Oh, okay, so it's over. Okay, good. All right, well."
That's upsetting.
That's that. It was and it wasn't. You know, I wasn't connecting to the movie, and I knew that I wasn't getting bits on. And you know, it's like you kind of want to hang around because everybody wants to make a paycheck. But creatively, it wasn't working out. So.
So obviously, this is before Late Night.
No, this is a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, as a side project.
Wow.
I was writing for Bruno a couple of weeks ago. No, yeah, it was way before Late Night. It was Yeah, about a year and a half or so, 2 years before Elite Night.
And so, you know, there's Bruno, and then, you know, there's that year and a half, and then the telephone rings, and it's somebody saying, hey, do you want to try out or do you want to meet for this position?
Right, and exactly. And it was the perfect aligning of stars of a job that I wasn't qualified for, and people were hiring. I guess I'd worn a lot of hats over my career being an actor and a writer and a director. So in the sense that I did have a lot of things to bring to the table, and the people that were hiring or looking for this particular job specifically were looking for someone that would be stepping up into it. The job is, it really wrings it out of you, and I think it jades a lot of people. And I think that the normal, like, people that had been doing it for a while or had done it on other shows, it's not as exciting to bring someone like that in, because they're going to be like, yeah, sure, I'll run your late night show. I've done this. Yeah, great, whatever. What are we doing, some bits, desk pieces? Okay, yeah, I've done this a million times. Whereas I had no experience in it, and they were looking for that kind of person. I was that kind of person. And so it was a great serendipitous meeting.
Now, was your first meeting for the job with Lorne Michaels, or did you have to go through a step process?
There was a two-step process. I met first with Michael Shoemaker, Gavin Purcell, and Jimmy Fallon. And then after that, I had to go and meet with Lorne Michaels.
Now, he's the kingmaker. He has been for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine it, or maybe it wasn't. Was it intimidating walking into
that
office?
Extremely, of course. I was actually in L.A. at the time, and I met Lorne at the Beverly Hotel in the Polo Lounge.
Where else would you meet Lorne Michaels?
Of course.
But the Polo Lounge.
Where else would you meet him? And I was told to be prepared.
Please tell me he was dressed in a polo outfit.
He was. He was carrying a mallet, and he was riding a stuffed pony, which I thought was weird, but it was very effective. Yeah. No, got my attention. No, I was told to be prepared for a lengthy wait, because that's just the way it is. And so I brought a book, and Lorne was right on time. There was no wait at all. And he is disarmingly charming in a way that I was prepared to be, I was intimidated. I was excited because it was a legend. And, but within, I would say minutes, I would say 10 minutes, I felt completely at ease. And I felt like I was, talking to my dad or somebody. And we had an hour long meeting, and it was fantastic. And I remember leaving and feeling really good about it.
So now you get on to Late Night, and the show hasn't mm-hmm. aired yet. You're creating Late Night mm-hmm. with Jimmy and mm-hmm. with Gavin Purcell and Mike Shoemaker.
Mm-hmm.
How do you even wrap your head around that process? Because as revered as The Tonight Show is, maybe not as revered, but it's got its own history.
Oh, of course.
And
you
got
yeah.
and you're following now Conan, who followed Letterman who mm-hmm. created the franchise.
Sure.
How do you even begin to approach that?
Well, we approached it with an extreme naivete in the sense that we didn't – we just kind of started putting stuff together. And I will tell you, there were plenty of times in that first year where I genuinely thought I was going to have a heart attack. I was – there. It's that network moment, the network, the movie, where you're running down a hallway and, like, it's like the walk and talk from West Wing or something like that, where you're walking and there's people that are behind you and they're throwing papers your way, and, like, you're trying to think of the last joke as you're running towards a thing, and you feel like your heart is going to explode out of your chest because the stress and the tension is so high. And you think, there's just no way I can do this tomorrow, let alone the day after that or weeks after that. And then we're 1,000 episodes into it 5 years later. And you asked the question earlier about, like, does a stress or something
ever become comfortable in it?
No. And I was just going to say that even today, today was a good day. Today, everything worked. Like, we had really good material in the morning pitch meeting, and it was produced well, and the show came together in a good way. But there were at least two moments where the turnaround is so there's just – it's dialed into the minute, where we leave one meeting at 3:45, and by 4:11, everything has to be completely polished so that cue cards can start writing it. And you're thinking so quickly that, you know, a slight bobble or mistake puts you – really against the wall, and it's a or behind the eight ball, to use a correct metaphor.
Well, it could be behind the wall too. Either way is fine.
And it's just today I had those moments where I was just so stressed out, and then I guess the only difference is you just get so used to that feeling that it doesn't. You know that you're gonna do it. You've done it 1,000 times already, and you're gonna get on the other side of it, and you'll be fine. So yeah, and a weird way it becomes like a drug. You get so there's a feeling I have after the first act has taped, where I go back to my desk and I'm sitting down with nothing really to think about or do in the next few minutes for the first time since 9:45 in the morning. So it's now 5:30, 5:45. And there is such a palpable sense of relief and euphoria that comes from knowing that you've done it, that whatever else happens, your stuff's to bed, and now you can kind of zone out for a moment. And that feeling is a little bit like a drug, and you get really used to it.
Is it similar to the feeling you got from performing? I mean, you still do perform on the show.
Exactly. Yeah, it's exactly the same feeling that you get performing. The most heightened sense of performing that I can think of that could demonstrate it is doing the monologues at ASCAT, which is a completely free form. They give you one word and you got to make up a monologue, blah, blah, blah. And every time I've ever been asked to do that, I right before the show, I'm furious at myself. I think this is the worst decision ever. I will never do this again. And then if it goes even remotely well right afterwards, you're like, what's the big deal? This is so fun. We should do this all the time. And it's like you just get so excited about it. And it's the same when you do stand up. You just like right before, you're just like, oh, my God, this is dumb. We shouldn't do this to ourselves. And then you get a laugh or two and you walk off stage and you just, you know, you want to buy everybody drinks because it's like, you know.
Because you're a genius.
Yeah, you're a genius. It all worked.
Today we're talking to A.D. Miles, the head writer of The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. Left to his own devices, Miles spends his time creating acerbic internet parody series like Horrible People and Hot Sluts. But more of Miles' own comedic voice makes it into The Tonight Show than you might think. Coming up, I talk to him about his work as a stand-up comedian, his early days as an evangelical robot, and how these experiences led him to his current career on The Tonight Show, including the popular Ragtime Gals Barbershop Quartet segment, of which he is a baritone. When you came to New York originally, was it to be a stand-up?
No. I came to New York to live in New York. I came to New York when I was 14 with my dad. He was a banker, and he came on a business trip and brought me with him. And I always was very attracted. Ironically enough, the beginning opening credits of Late Night with David Letterman was that old where the camera would travel through the apartments and all that kind of stuff. I watched that, and it happened all at night, and there was the steam coming out of the manhole cover and all that stuff. And that stuck with me, and it made me want to move to New York City, those images that I saw. And it wasn't to be a comedian or working late night. I just was so entranced by New York City. And I came to New York with my dad on that business trip. And my dad's always given me a lot of freedom. And basically, he would go to work and he'd be like, just be back at the hotel at 5 and go wander around. And I was a 14-year-old kid from Tennessee, that had never been here before. And I just, when we came back from that trip, I was like, as soon as I'm on my own, I'm moving here. And I did. I graduated from college and I moved there, moved here that summer.
So how did you find comedy for yourself?
My best friend in college was Zach Galifianakis. And he also moved to New York City at the same time. And that was the fall of 1992, I believe, around October. And we got drunk for the first 2 years that we were here and didn't really do anything except a lot of really weird, odd jobs. And Zach started doing open mics, and we were funny. And I always was funny. You know, I knew that I was going to be a writer of some kind. I wanted to be a writer, television writer. I wasn't sure if it's comedy or I had a lot of dreams about being like a corduroy jacket with elbow patches and writing novels and drinking whiskey.
You're not so far from that.
I'm not.
Right
so
now.
I do drink a lot of whiskey and I do wear a lot of elbow patches, but I haven't written a novel yet. I'm still working on that. Zach started doing open mics, and it just kind of like shamed me into kind of moving in that direction, because I was like, well, if he's gonna do it, then I'm gonna do it. and I'm sorry that it didn't work out for Zach, because yeah. You know, he was so funny, and it just you know, he just, I don't know, he never connected with an audience and just it didn't work out. But, yeah. You know.
What's the last name again?
Galifianakis.
I'll write it down and I'll look for it.
Down.
I don't know that I can write it down, but I'll, I'll Google him. So how would you describe your stand-up when you started doing it? I've seen a lot of it.
Oh, okay. Well,
but for our listeners who aren't as familiar with the A.D. Miles stand-up.
Well, my stand-up was more in service of getting jobs in a writing career. I would, in the sense of like Zach or Todd Barry or yourself even, who have done a lot of extensive touring and really done a lot of stand-up. I wouldn't count myself in that world. I've really enjoyed it, but it's been limited mostly to New York and in the sense of just being part of the community. But I would. The best stand-up I ever did was after I got divorced, because I finally had. I think I struggled at the beginning with not really. I would just sort of riff off absurd premises that I would make up, and it wasn't real in the sense that I wasn't really connecting to people as much. I remember to bring back Stella. I would do characters, basically, mm-hmm. a stand-up. And I did a character named Marty Shonson, and I sort of formed it doing Stella when we were down at the, what was the place called?
The Fez.
The Fez, yeah. And I remember one night I did Marty Shonson in this, it's like an 8-minute routine at the Fez at Stella, and crushed. Like, it was one of the best sets ever. And it was one of those rare things where I also had a set the very same night at... In Midtown at, what's it called?
Hamburger Harry's?
Not Hamburger Harry's. No, the bigger one.
Caroline's?
Caroline's. It was at Caroline's. And I had it set the exact same night. And I got off stage at Fez and I was just like, would love to hang out, but I got a set in Midtown. So sorry, got to run, got a jet. Oh, God, I don't know where I am. I'm coming, I'm going. Anyway, I'll talk to you guys later. I went and did the set at Caroline's and literally got booed off the stage. 45 minutes after I felt like I'd gotten a standing ovation downtown, the ironic, we get the deconstruction of stand-up jokes that you're doing. In Midtown, it was tourists who wanted to hear, you know, real jokes. And I remember one of my lines was like, I feel like I'm talking to a brick wall. And somebody in the audience goes, you're a brick wall. And it didn't feel good. It wasn't funny now. It did not feel good. It was a real bummer. But anyway, then after I got divorced, I actually had some sort of life experience that was bitter and dark and was
perfect.
Great fodder for doing stand-up.
That's why I encourage comedians to end relationships and get divorced.
Yeah. It's great.
We actually have a clip of some of your stand-up, more in the Marty Shonson vein of you doing a little rap. So why don't we take a listen?
All right.
Now, I didn't ask for this skill. God gave me the skill of rap, and I'm going to use it to tell you a little bit about myself. Here we go, guys. And by the way, I'm Lily White, so this beat may vary a little bit. My name is A.D. The A is for Anthony. The D is for something that you do not need to be worrying about.
So I can't imagine why that wouldn't
That's
go
it?
Over with a tourist group
in
Midtown.
That did not go over. That did not go over. I came up with that while we were making Wet Hot American Summer.
I love that. You could do more of it if you want.
My name is A.D., the A is for Anthony. The D is for something that you do not need to be worrying about. I walk on the sidewalk, not on the street, because I don't want a car to roll over my feet. Because with a flat foot, I couldn't walk very good. And you know I have to be able to walk, because I'm the kind of guy who says what he means. And if I'm going to talk the talk, then I have to be able to walk the walk as well.
Bravo.
It's on a hair trigger, man. When you only got 3 bits, you got to have them ready.
Well, but you were also doing Barbershop Quartet back then.
And still do.
I know.
The Ragtime Gals on The Tonight Show.
So I assume you brought that to Jimmy.
I did. And that was something that I did with Tom Shalhoub, who is a legitimately award-winning, nationally competitive barbershop quartet singer. Our group was called Forewarned. And we did it at Fez.
I know you did.
And it's super fun, and love it, love it. I still love it. There's just something. I was in the church choir growing up. I love to sing, and harmony is a great way to
Sing.
Trick the audience into thinking you're funny.
I've been around the world, don't speak the language, but your booty don't need explaining. All I really need to understand is when you talk dirty to me.
Tra-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la-la-la.
One of the things that I've noticed about Jimmy's show and now Seth's show, the newer generation of late night talk show hosts, to me, almost seems like they're moving in kind of a reaction to the more caustic Letterman model, Conan model, Craig Kilborn model of like the 90s. First of all, do you agree with that? Second of all, how much of that is conscious, this kind of gentler tone?
I do agree with it. I don't think it's conscious. I don't think that we set out to zig where the other guys zagged. But I think that it's a natural evolution. I think that what the Conan and Letterman guys were doing was they were breaking down the previous generation, mm-hmm. which was very straight ahead, sincere, sort of lauding the stars of the day. And then they broke it down, and Letterman was, you know, jumping up against a wall with Velcro on, dropping, you know, hams off the roof and things like that, which was extremely funny because no one had been, well, I guess there's been a little bit of it before, but, you know, that was where it became mainstream. And then I guess at a certain point, absurd for absurdity's sake just starts to become a little boring, you know, like it isn't as much a joke as just actually thinking of a joke. But I also think it's honestly an extension of who Jimmy is. Jimmy is a pretty genuinely talented and enthusiastic person who kind of really is more excited about execution than he is about just, I mean, we do tons of dumb stuff for dumb stuff's sake, so I don't want to be too proud about it. But it's really more about, like, you know, the barbershop is a perfect example because, you know, for that four-minute bit, there is an enormous amount of work that goes into the sheet music and breaking down whatever song that we're, like, rap song that we're doing, and then hours and hours of rehearsal to figure it out and sing it and make it correct, because that's what makes it funny, is that we're doing a Shaggy song in four-part harmony, but it wouldn't be funny if we sucked. Mm-hmm. It's only funny if the harmonies are really tight and perfect, and so that takes time to make it work. And so that's not the same thing as, say, throwing a ham off the roof, although it's very funny. This is a different approach, I suppose.
You talked about quality control earlier, and you said that your job is to kind of be the gatekeeper for quality control, stuff that gets to Jimmy. How do you know? I mean, is it just that you now know his voice so well that, I mean, what's the difference between something that works and doesn't work? Is it subtle, or is it just gut at this point?
It's mostly gut. You're always looking to make sure that we don't keep going so close to the middle of what we know will work that we just keep repeating ourselves over and over. That you're kind of always looking, that the perfect place to be is right on that sort of boundary of like, Jimmy's going to think this is either really funny or it's really stupid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't really know. You want to kind of be right there on that edge because you don't want to get bored. He doesn't want to get bored. But you also don't want to go so far in the extreme of just showing him, you know, throwing spaghetti against the wall every day and be like, what about this? What about this? Because we don't have the time for it. We write so much material that Jimmy never even sees. And it's all about sort of like going as far as you can and then going to that little edge and then coming back a few feet, and that's kind of where you the stuff that you're trying to show to get in front of Jimmy.
So what makes a good writer for The Tonight Show? Do different people bring different skills?
Really, as I've gone through it over the last 5 years, the ability to construct and execute a good, solid, tight joke. The idea that there's some sort of like great abstract thinker that can just come up with these crazy sketch ideas. I used to think that. I feel like if you're a good joke writer, you can do that. That's the thing that anyone can do. Writing good jokes is the premium that I look for now.
So if somebody's listening and thinks to themselves, you know, I'd like to do that someday. Mm-hmm. What how does somebody learn how to do that? How does somebody learn how to write a joke?
It's the same way, I guess, you learn how to write the write the piano.
Yeah, sure.
Learn how to play the piano. It's like you just play scales over and over. A perfect example is our supervising monologue writers, a guy named John Reinman, who used to be a faxer for Leno. And what
is that?
It's where you're not really on staff, but you fax in jokes, and if they like one or two, they send you.
Did Leno not have email?
No, he had a teletype, and that was the only way that you could get material to him. He did that for a really long time, and then was a staff writer. And you know, he's just written so many jokes that, and unpaid, sort of, you know, in the sense of not being on an actual staff, that he honed his process. And you know, it's a real skill and a very, very highly prized skill.
Is this a job that you see yourself staying in indefinitely? I mean, it sounds exhausting.
It is exhausting. And you think, you know, Mike Sweeney was a head writer for Conan and has been for many, many years. I remember I went to him when I first got the job, and I asked him for a meeting because I was just like, dude, can you give me any advice? And the thing that struck me most about him, he'd been doing it for a really long time, was this sort of very, like, crazy Zen calm about him. And it was like, I remember I met with him in his office, and I think it was like 30 minutes before showtime. And I'm thinking, how are you not losing your brain right now? It's 30 minutes. And he just seemed very calm. And it's weird. I talk about the stress and everything, but you get used to it. And I would say on average, every day I have two or three moments where I have a genuine belly laugh and usually it's in service to some sort of bit that I'm doing with someone that it's unprintable and nothing you would ever put on television, but like have tears coming out of my eyes. I'm laughing so hard. And that, the joy of that and the experience of doing that every day is something I could imagine myself doing forever.
Are you able to turn it off when you go home?
No. Much to the dismay of my wife, I cannot turn it off. And there's a tone or a timbre in my voice where I start to lie and do a bit that I'll say, you know, honey, and she'll be like, oh, what? What's the bit? I mean, I'll literally get that much out, and she's learned that I'm teeing up some dumb joke that I've thought of. And
are we married to the same woman?
I think, and we are the same man. No, I think that it's not something I can turn off.
So you grew up in Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
And were you a creative kid? Was there anything in your upbringing that made you think you were going to be in the arts?
Gosh, it's such a cliche, but I was a class clown.
Were you?
Oh, yeah. I was the funny guy. I was a late bloomer. I was the latest of all late bloomers.
I'm not sure you've bloomed yet.
Maybe not. I still look 9 years old, but I definitely looked 9 when I was in high school. And my way of surviving and not getting my ass kicked on a daily basis was to be funny. And still got my ass kicked a couple of times, mm-hmm. but probably less so than if I hadn't been funny. I was a jokester.
But you said there was no part of you that was thinking, I'm going to go into comedy.
No, my dad's very naturally funny, and I saw that as a way of disarming people, and you know, I thought that it was a way to get girls, but it was a good way to get girls to be your friend. It was a good way to get girls laughing and feeling very comfortable so that a good-looking dude could come along,
sure.
And make out with them.
Yeah, they felt safe around
you.
Yeah. That's always good.
Thanks, Miles. Oh, I've had a great time tonight.
I wonder, I mean, I grew up in a similar way in the sense that, I mean, I didn't know anybody in the arts. Was that even a possibility? I mean, maybe pre-internet, it's hard to imagine that there was a time when you'd have no concept of being on a TV show.
Yeah, but I had a good imagination. I remember when I would go see movies with my dad, I would leave the theater and I would think that I was in that movie. Like, I really became the thing that I just saw. If I went and saw a James Bond movie, then I'd be on the lookout when we left the theater for any kind of, like, you know, spies.
I still do that.
I still do it. I actually really do. And it's like, there, and I think that there's a sense that there was always that imagination and stuff. And, you know, my dad had all the Bill Cosby records and I would listen to them all the time. And I obviously thought, you know, that was really funny. And I would, the Chicken Heart That Ate New York City was the first bit that I ever memorized from a Bill Cosby record. And the Smothers Brothers he had. And so I was exposed to it, but I was also extremely religious growing up. And, you know, I was in the church choir and we put on plays and I was always in those plays. So I was performing, but it was always in the service of witnessing to get people to join the church, but not necessarily for show business. But I do think that training was the same as if you'd been doing it anywhere.
I've often wondered about, because I'm not religious myself, but when you grow up in that environment and you're performing in church plays and sort of doing those things in service of witnessing, mm-hmm. how much of that is in service of witnessing and how much of it is like, hey, I get to be on stage and perform?
It is 100% about getting on stage and performing.
That's what I always suspected.
No, it is 100%. It was just like, what's the agenda? Oh, yeah, witnessing. Great. Okay. Anyway, I get to put on a robot costume and prance around in front of these hot girls. So that's totally 100% what it was.
Right. You went to the Church of the Robots.
Yeah, I went to the Church of the Robots. But one of my first acting jobs was playing a robot in a church play called Christmas 2001, uh-huh. in which I was a robot from the future that came back and became a Christian.
The robot became a Christian.
The robot became a Christian, yeah. Huh.
Can robots go to heaven? All robots go to heaven would be a great movie.
All robots go to heaven.
I want to see that on the Tonight Show.
Do we sort of both own it, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll just take a recording.
Let me wet my beak.
So then you went to college, and where'd you go to school?
I went to NC State, North Carolina State University. And I majored in business for a little while because I thought I was going to be Donald Trump.
Right.
I read The Art of the Deal, and I thought that was something that I wanted to do. I hated it with a white-hot passion, and I had one teacher, and I'm sure every teacher's had this, every student's had this teacher that basically said, like, if you were, you know, the whole, like, if you were guaranteed to be successful and had no fear of failure, what would you do? And I'd be like, oh, I'd move to New York City. I'd be a writer. Mm-hmm. And he was like, well, then you should start doing that. And I did. I changed my major the next day to communications, which was a sort of catch-all major for people that didn't really have any direction. And I took film and television production and radio production and had a great time. And then I met Zach, and my friend Matt and I decided that we were going to move to New York City.
And you did.
And then we did.
And so how did you end up working in the art department on the state? And then at it was the Global Shopping Network? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, it was the Global Home Shopping Network. It was strictly about money. It was all about, like, just paying my rent. And we started doing stand-up and doing open mics. I got, you know, a job. My first job in New York City was at Buns of Steel, an exercise video company that makes aerobics videos. Mm-hmm. Or made aerobics. I don't know if they still exist.
They exist.
Oh, yeah. The buns definitely exist. No longer of steel, but still they exist. And then one of the connections that I knew... Molly Fitzsimmons, I believe, was in the art department at the state, and somebody dropped out, and I went over and did props, and then ended up staying there for like the last two seasons, I think, and then that introduced me to you guys, and I knew that I wanted to be a writer, and I was already doing stand up, and then I think my real introduction to you and to the rest of the guys was with Stella and doing all those short films, which was unbelievably fun.
Yeah. All right. So. If at some point the job at The Tonight Show ends, what would you like to do next? Do you still have that novel in you?
No, I don't think there's a novel in me. I've sat on many a rooftop and smoked many a cigarettes trying to summon that novel. I don't think that it really exists. I think that I would just look for something else in the world that we've been working in. I think I'd probably try to act again. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a great moment with I hung out with Matt Walsh recently. He's on Veep, and I was talking to him. I was like, you know, I think I might I might come back out to L.A. I might try to be an actor. And he goes, no, don't. Goes, ship sailed, Miles. And I was like, really? And he's like, yeah, don't do it. You're in a good place. There we are. I think that I would, though. I think that I would. I imagine myself being like a character actor or something like that. I mean,
yeah.
It would be a fun way to make a living. And I think that I would just try to write and sell stuff the same way I did before.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're basically living...
Horrible people, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Hot sluts.
Yeah.
Redux.
Yeah, exactly.
What about movies? I mean, do you fancy yourself a screenwriter?
Absolutely. No, I would love to. And I've got, you know, like everybody else, I've got a few screenplays in the drawer. But, God, it's just, you know, I work 60 hours a week. And then on the weekends, I stare into space. And the idea of sitting down and trying to write comedy... For those brief times when I'm not actually doing it, it's very difficult.
Right. Well, as long as you're not paying any attention to your daughter, which it sounds like.
No, I'm not. I'm sure that Roberta will get to know Ruby. Sorry, Ruby will get to know me very soon.
She can see on the TV.
Yeah.
You must be exposed to a lot of comedy on The Tonight Show that isn't yours. You know, people coming in or people, new writers maybe.
Mm-hmm.
What do you find inspiring in comedy right now? What makes you laugh at this point? Is it just that you does anything make you laugh? I mean, aside from the kind of inside jokes?
No. It's not even inside jokes. I mean, we do our monologue every night. It sounds so Pollyanna-ish, but like we do our monologue every night, which is, you know, it's pretty. A lot of it's straight down the middle. I think what makes me laugh is the execution of bits and just in joking around and the joy that you get from joking around and being silly. And if there's anything that I guess new writers coming in or the other writers on the show, it's that it's the unexpected turn is always the one where you're just truly delighted when you just weren't expecting that thing to come out. There was a joke tonight, which I probably won't translate out of context, but where we were talking about Obamacare and they just reached 6 million people. And one of the roots goes, 6 million and 1, Jimmy. And then he goes on and he talks about how he just signed up, but he thinks it's a dating site. And he says, and I just met a girl and she's a doctor.
Mark, I think you just made an appointment.
I made a connection, Jimmy. What's more is she's a proctologist, which is great because I love dinosaurs.
And that just, I wasn't expecting that line, and I thought that was just really, really funny.
Yeah.
And so it's, I guess, you know, there's, I guess, so many structures for jokes, probably not that many, but when you can find a way to do a little turn at the end where you catch someone off guard, I mean, that's what I like to look for, and it's what makes me laugh.
Well, you've delighted me throughout this interview, Miles.
Really?
And I like to end How to Be Amazing with the Amazing Five.
Oh, my God.
What or who are you? Do you find amazing in film?
Coen Brothers.
Music?
Johnny Cash is what keeps coming to my brain.
Television?
I'm stalling because that's a tough one because it all just becomes. I think when you work in it, it just becomes a mishmash of white noise. I'm watching House of Cards right now, which I really like, and I like the model.
Yeah, sure.
But there's just so many things.
Why don't you just go with House of Cards then? I mean, I don't want you to lose any sleep over this. Just
let it be. Don't hurt yourself, Miles.
Food. Oh,
can I just
yeah.
Can I say House of Curds?
Well, that would lead right into food. Should I even ask you about food then?
My favorite thing is a roast chicken, which I am so good at. I can do it in my sleep, and it's fantastic. It never fails. I've got the perfect spice mixture. I know exactly how to make it. In 45 minutes, cast iron pan in the oven. It's unbelievable.
I understand if the answer is you can't, but can you share with us your spice mixture?
Oh, of course. I coat the bird in olive oil, and I have a silicone brush that I use to make sure the oil gets in all the nooks and crannies. I then go with garlic powder. I follow that with regular paprika, a lot of paprika.
Yeah, you don't want to skimp on the paprika.
Nope. a little bit of smoked Spanish paprika after that. It's got a little bit more bite, but it's too spicy if you use all of it. Then those are the powdery spices. We want to get those on there. And then I go with fresh ground pepper, very liberal. And then I do salt. And I'm very liberal with the salt because it dries out the skin and it makes it crispy. You then preheat your oven to 425, 450. The oven's cold. You put your cast iron pan in there about 10, 15 minutes later. Pull the pan out. It's nice and hot. Plop the bird on there, breast side up. Put the whole thing back in the oven, low rack, 45 minutes undisturbed.
Got yourself a roast chicken.
Perfect. It's beautiful. Put your meat thermometer into the thickest part of the thigh. Make sure it's 165 so I don't kill anyone. But
there it is, the 80 Miles Roast Chicken, guaranteed perfect recipe. And the final of the Amazing Five, potpourri. Anything else in the world right now that you find amazing?
The most boring answer in the world is my kid. Unbelievable. I completely underestimated how much fun and how mind-blowing raising another human being is. It really is the most, I love it. And my chode, which I made myself.
Well, 80 Miles... I want to thank you. You've been amazing.
Thank you.
On how to be amazing. Join us next time. My name is Michael Ian Black.
Thank you.
Sure, end with my name like a dick.
Oh, God. And I am Michael Ian Black. And that is all you need to remember.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @HTBA_show. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. Today's show is mixed and edited by Kristen Clark with music from Chad Crouch. I'm Michael Ian Black.
Dude, I had a couple of places where I flamed out. I lost my train of
thought. No, you haven't flamed out at all.
Oh, okay. There was a couple of moments where I felt like I lost my train of thought.
You flamed in.
I flamed in. Girl.